phone.
Songs that just makes you feel good. Woolly Bully, originally by Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, yeah, but covered there beautifully by the Smithereens. Remembering Tom Petty with an alternate version of You Wreck Me from Finding Wildflowers. Bill Miller of the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican in there with Time from Chronicles of Hope. And we heard from The Deer, you know, like Bambi, like the deer. I Wouldn't Recognize Me. It's Undercurrents. I'm Greg McVicker. Back with Master of the Voice, Bobby McFerrin, in just a minute.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO on Monday, January 16th at 1 p.m. for the live broadcast of the 38th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Tribute. This annual tribute event at the Highland Christian Center features stage performances and speakers, including Danelle Damon and Greater Works Choir. That's the live broadcast of the 38th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Tribute, broadcasting from the Highland Christian Center on Monday, January 16th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you were invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, over the past decades, some notable entrepreneurs and celebrities have opened up about their bold, life-changing experiences with psychedelics, experiences that led to personal healing and success. But less well-known are the wisdom-developing psychedelic experiences of psychologists, psychiatrists, researchers, and others who have taken what they personally learned from their entheogenic experiences and applied it to their professions, leading to therapeutic advancements, scientific discoveries, and healing for thousands. Now their stories are coming out, which we are going to be exploring today on Pathways. Our guest is Dr. Richard Miller, author of the new book, Psychedelic Wisdom. Richard has been a clinical psychologist for more than 60 years. He is the host of the internet broadcast Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, the founder of the internationally acclaimed Coke Enders Alcohol and Drug Program, as well as the creator of the Health Sanctuary at Wilbur Hot Springs, California. He has been a faculty member at the University of Michigan and Stanford University, an advisor on the President's Commission on Mental Health, and author of Psychedelic Medicine, Psychedelic Wisdom, and a forthcoming book, Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Sex Unveiled. He lives in Fort Bragg, California, and at the Health Sanctuary at Wilbur Hot Springs. Well, hello, Richard, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction, Paul.
Well, you know, I loved your book. I just found it fascinating to hear these stories of these psychedelic elders. And I'm just wondering, why did you put together this book? What inspired you? What was your motivation?
Well, it's a this story goes back a long ways, because I was teaching at the University of Michigan, 1967, and LSD was made illegal. And as you know, marijuana had already been made illegal. In 1985, coming later, MDMA was illegal, made illegal. And this was nothing short of shocking for me, because from my perspective, science is repressed or suppressed in totalitarian countries. Russia, China, I expect countries like that to suppress anything that might be a threat to their governmental structure. But I never expected the American government to suppress science at the highest level of university research. And that, in fact, is what our United States government did. And as soon as they did that, of course, certain people around the United States started experimenting with these substances because they were in the news as a result of what happened with Leary and Alpert at Harvard, which everyone knows about. And we had an interesting thing happen in that these very same substances, let's take LSD, for example, is both a drug, if you take it, quote, recreationally, like on a Saturday morning, I think I'll take LSD and go out in the park. But that very same substance is also a medicine. And so what the government did by making the research illegal was they made a medicine with great potential for healing human beings of various ailments. They made the research illegal on this and other psychedelics as well. So people around the United States were experimenting recreationally, but a certain group of people, particularly psychologists, clinical psychologists, and some psychiatrists, were still interested in this medicine, even though they could not do direct open research about it. So what they did was the next best thing. They experimented upon themselves, and they experimented upon their families. And to a certain extent, sub rosa, they experimented on patients. And so we had this underground experimentation that I was quite aware of that was going on all around the United States, if not the world. But it was all going on below the radar.
Right.
Then some of us were working together to get the government to change its mind. Another aspect of what's referred to as the drug wars. But we weren't warring against anybody. We were simply trying to get the government to open up a bit, allow some research, allow us some experimentation. And so the idea of the book was that if I can show people, the government, the average person, that prominent citizens, contributory citizens, good fathers and mothers, well-respected people, have been experimenting with these substances for decades and having positive results, I thought it might make a contribution to affecting some cultural change.
Yeah, no, and I hope that that's the result, because it certainly deserves it. I thoroughly enjoyed this book, and it really spoke to me, because I was one of those people who grew up in the Bay Area in the late 60s. And, you know, it's, to me, the concept of taking LSD recreationally is just kind of like a bizarre, it's like a bizarre concept, because it's not necessarily unmitigated fun, but it's very... it's very opening, you know. To me, I took LSD a lot, and I knew some people who had a source, and but I needed it, you know. I felt like I had been brainwashed my whole life. I needed it to sort of like open my mind and decondition myself. I always thought of it as a serious sacramental thing, even though I was taking it. I'm walking down Telegraph Avenue and I'm going to Sproul Plaza, and people could say, well, that was recreational, but you know, to me it was educational. And so I read your book and I thought, oh man, this is so right on. It's just so interesting to hear the scientists and what they concluded. And there's some people in your book, like there's a guy in there who took LSD, what, 900 times or something? Or it's unbelievable. So there's just so much value in your book. Now, so you tend to refer to LSD as a sacrament, and that's kind of the way I see it. To call it a drug is pretty demeaning. But let's move on and ask you, how do you classify the interviewees in your book? I mean, what's the criteria for a psychedelic elder in when you were putting this together?
Okay, first of all, the doctor who took LSD 900 times is Dr. Alan Ajaya, who lives in Wisconsin. And one of the fun things that I liked about the interview with Alan was that when I asked him, as I asked a lot of the elders, if they intend to continue experimenting with LSD, he said, well, definitely. And I said, definitely? After 900 times? Definitely? You're going to do it again? And he very calmly said, there's always more to learn.
Right.
There's always more to learn. So that was the wisdom coming down from that psychedelic elder.
I've interviewed Ram Dass a few times on this show before he had a stroke. And I asked him, I said, well, you're associated with LSD and with psychedelic experience. Do you still take psychedelics? And he goes, yeah, I do. I take it at least every couple of years. And I go, why do you do that? And he goes, just to make sure I haven't forgotten anything. And so I hadn't taken LSD for like 10 years at that point. This was in the late 80s. And so I thought, but I had some that I had gotten back in the day from the manager of the Grateful Dead or somebody like that. And it was blotter acid. I knew it was really clean stuff. So I thought, oh, well, I wonder if I've forgotten anything. So I went to the coast and I rented a house for the weekend. And I brought some tapes of Robert Bly reciting Rumi poetry to a sitar and tabla, and I took LSD and I just stayed up all night. So are there any dangers to psychedelic medicines?
Well, the dangers are not in the medicines themselves. Mm-hmm. For example, Dr. Dave Nichols, who's the foremost LSD scientist on the planet, I interviewed him on my program, Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. And he said, there isn't one recorded death from taking LSD. Even in gigantic amounts, people have taken several thousand micrograms by mistake. No recorded deaths. There have been, I'm answering your question in terms of worst case, you know, what's the right, negative right. effect? The worst thing is dying. And so, you know, can you die from these things? There have been incidents of people dying taking MDMA, but it's not from the MDMA. It's taking MDMA and then exhausting themselves and being dehydrated. Psilocybin, no deaths. There have been a few recorded deaths from ayahuasca, but it was not determined that it was the ayahuasca. We don't know for sure that the person had a previous condition and may have just died, but they happened to be taking ayahuasca when they died. So right. In terms of mortality, I would take that off the table. So what are the real dangers that a person has to deal with? The real dangers are when you use the material recreationally instead of medicinally, and I'd like to describe what I mean by the two of those circumstances. Mm-hmm. When you use it recreationally, there's always the possibility that you're going to open up something inside of yourself that's going to be extremely difficult to deal with. You may open up a can full of demons. You may open up your worst fears in the world. You may open up horrendous trauma that you experienced that you had sealed off in your consciousness and were not aware of on a daily basis.
Right.
These things can come out, and they can come out and be terrifying.
Yeah.
Now, when these terrifying experiences come out in a recreational situation, the person is terrified and they don't know what the heck to do about it. And
right.
They have to just live through that terror and be with that terror for the hours and hours, perhaps, until the substance wears off.
Right.
The exact same experience, when used as a medicine with the proper protocol, so that there's a guide sitting right next to you and you're in a specially chosen environment,
mm-hmm.
when that material comes up, it's wonderful because the guide can then take you through that stuff and you can heal it if it's an old trauma.
Right.
You can look the demon right in the face and you can achieve mastery. You can come out with a sense of less fear because you have faced your fears. So exact same substance, exact same person, in one situation, terrifying, in another situation, healing and offering more confidence and less fear.
You know, it always occurred to me that people who have a personality disorder should not take psychedelics. Like if they have a narcissistic personality disorder or a borderline personality disorder where maintaining their ego structure and ego defenses seems like a matter of life and death to them, I think that those people probably should avoid it. Would you agree with that?
Actually, I think those people are the people that definitely should take it, but definitely should not take it recreationally. You're 100% right, Paulo. They should not take it recreationally, but they should take it in the proper professionally guided circumstance so they can come to grips with the tight grip they're holding on their ego and let it dissolve and look at what's behind it. And look at what it is that they're holding on to. And look at what their worst fears are, their traumas. And so they can live a different life and perhaps be significantly less narcissistic and less on the border of going into something very terrifying.
Right. You know, you make the point, or somebody in your book makes the point, that drugs can be a block to your maturity and development if you keep dredging things up without integrating them. And this kind of ties in with what you just said.
It ties in exactly, Paulo, because the experience of taking the psychedelic substance is one aspect of the total picture of using it properly. The first aspect is meeting with the guide and setting your intention, knowing where you want to go, selecting the place where you're going to meet, getting a good night's sleep beforehand. The second phase is the actual taking of the substance. And then comes the next day, the next weeks, the next months, which is what you're referring to, which is the integration of what you've learned. Because after all, if you go exploring, whether it's into the jungle or into your mind, if you don't bring something back that you can use, it was just another experience. But if you can bring something back that you can use, it's a gift that keeps on giving.
Right. You know, in the book, there is talk about the importance of intention, which you just brought up. And somebody, one of your interviewees, or maybe it was you, said, my feeling is that no matter what the intention, there's a deeper level within ourselves that guides us into what is going to unfold. It's important to be open to the intention that arises out of these depths. I thought that was a really skillful distinction to make, because we can become very intentional, and that can be the ego driving us in a direction that's not really what's needed right now.
That is correct, Paul. Apollo. That is correct. We can have our conscious intention. I want to work on a trauma that happened between me and my father. But while we're under the influence, other stuff can slip out of the box and be dominant.
Right.
And forming what you refer to as having its own intention. And it's important to pay attention to that stuff that comes out, and when appropriate, share it with the guide.
Right. Now, you talked about ayahuasca, and there's something, and I think you wrote this in the book, or this is you, about, I still don't buy into this theory or explanation that purging is psychological and you're getting rid of bad psychological stuff. You know, I found that very interesting, because people do make a kind of like a sacramental aspect to purging this kind of sacramental importance. And I've done ayahuasca 16 times, and I've never purged once, but I had really clean medicine. I wasn't in the deep, dark jungles of Peru, you know, where it's mixed with God knows what. I could imagine somebody dying from just the mixture of that they got, not knowing what's in it, or purging as a result of that. And maybe purging is a really positive thing when you're in an environment where trichinosis is rampant, or, you know, parasites or whatever.
That's exactly how this all came about. The natives needed a way to quickly purge because they didn't have refrigeration, and very often they would eat something that was bad. Right. So they were always looking for emetics in the jungle, some plant that would make them throw up. And this is something that they stumbled on. Well, when they stumbled on the emetic part of it, they also stumbled on the psychedelic part of it.
Right.
And so what then happened was some shaman made up this whole big story about how the purging is a big cycle. As I said in the book, and I'll say it again now, I've talked to Dr. Beyer, who wrote the book Talking to the Plants, and he's an ethnobotanist. I asked him directly. I said, is ayahuasca an emetic? He said, absolutely. It's an emetic. It makes you throw up. And there's another, I'm going to make another comment here about something that came out of the jungle that I think is misguided. For some reason, the ayahuascaros and the mescaleros, the shaman who use these vegetables that are psychedelic, they do their work at night. So very often ayahuasca experiences start at 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
Right.
And then you're up all night. I think that's a misguided protocol.
I agree.
I think the best time to take any psychedelic that's going to last 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours is about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, when you are at your best during the day, at your strongest, when you're at your most alert. And so you can then deal with everything, and then it's over and you can get a good night's sleep and be rested for your integration the next day. Starting at 9 or 10 at night, in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning, when the stuff is peaking, we are at our lowest, which is the diurnal sleep rhythm gets everything in us to slow down. So it's a very questionable endeavor.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. And I actually took ayahuasca a couple times on my own, because I've had so much psychedelic experience in my youth. I'm not really afraid of my ego dissolving. I really wasn't terrified about it. I did it. I started in the morning, and that was so much better for me. I don't want to pull an all nighter for any reason. But So we're coming towards the end of our talk today, unfortunately. But I want to ask you about Aldous Huxley, and would you consider, some people take LSD as a meditational approach, and would you consider taking psychedelics for the end of life transition? like Aldous Huxley.
Well, thanks, Paul. I'm actually in contract to write another book right now about the use of psychedelics for end-of-life healing, because it appears that there's great benefit to be had. The answer to your question of whether or not to take it while you're actually dying in those last hours or moments, of course, that's an individual choice, but I think it was an extremely courageous thing for Huxley to do. And of course, he was a courageous scientist, and he often used himself, as many scientists do, for experimentation. I'm giving it a lot of thought myself, Paulo, because I hope I have the courage to choose my own time, place, and method of dying. And if I have that courage, I may factor in psychedelics as well.
You said that they're using psychedelics like psilocybin to help people approach dying, particularly people that are terminally cancerous, et cetera.
We already have some data, Paulo, that it's very helpful for the anxiety and depression that some people have because of their fear of death. They use the psychedelics and they let go of the fear of death, and they become more accepting that it's just another developmental stage as part of life.
Well, we're having an epidemic of depression and anxiety these days because of all the uncertainty and the fact that we seem to be approaching death as a species. Do you think that psychedelics are helpful for this existential type of despair?
I think they're very helpful for this existential type of despair, because psychedelics can lead us to acceptance of life and what it is. It's a developmental process. We are born, we have a life, a certain time, each of us, and we die. That's a given.
Yeah.
So anything we do to fight that is fighting against what's going to happen.
Right. You know, I wish we had more time, because we have run out of time, and your book is so full of wisdom, and I want to thank you for writing it. It's done me a lot of good, and I hope all of our listeners check it out. But there's so much more we could explore, but we've run out of time. Maybe we can do this again on another episode of Pathways. But I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website. It's called mindbodyhealthpolitics.org. And I encourage people to go there and tap into your work, because you've been doing this for 60 years. You're awesome, man. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Paulo. It's been a lot of fun.
And for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late today, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Dr. Richard Miller, author of Psychedelic Wisdom. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm. and produced every Sunday morning by Donald Altman or myself at 8:30 USA Pacific time. But even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes, my YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Dr. Miller and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Find fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me. I put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that is probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent, but that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. And I'll really have no worries, I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio